And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. And we're at iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, December 31st, 2014. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Lisa Cron. Before we go on, though, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of my guest and me, and not those of the University of California Regents. Lisa Cron is the author of Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence, published by 10 Speed Press. And her video tutorial, Writing Fundamentals, The Craft of Story, can be found at lynda.com. Her TEDx talk, Wired for Story, opened Furman University's 2014 TEDx conference, Stories, the Common Thread of Our Humanity. She's worked in publishing at W.W. Norton, as an agent at the Angela Rinaldi Literary Agency, and as a producer on shows for Showtime and Court TV, and as a story consultant for Warner Brothers and the William Morris Agency. Since 2006, she's been an instructor in the UCLA Extension Writers Program. Her passion has always been story, and she currently works as a story coach, helping writers, nonprofits, educators, and journalists wrangle the story they're telling onto the page. Let me bring her on. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here. Last day of the year.
I know. Oh. This has to be a good omen in some way for something.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
Well, you know, let's start by you talking about your path to Wired for Story.
Sure. I have actually loved stories since I was, like all of us, since I was a little kid. When I was a kid, actually, for a long time, I decided to see every movie that was ever made. And for many, many years, I actually did that. And then when I went into publishing, I started reading manuscripts and evaluating them, and they were very different from the stories that I saw out there in the world. And the really interesting thing that I started to notice over a period of time, which you can only notice over a period of time and reading, you know, manuscript after manuscript, is that most of them really did not succeed. But the really, really interesting thing, the thing that struck me the most, was that the reasons they didn't work were very different than what you would think they would be, and also that the reasons they didn't work were really pretty much the same across the board. I mean, yeah, sure, each writer, you know, made the specific mistake in their own, you know, individual way, but there was something that was missing in all of them, and that's kind of got me to thinking, okay, well, what is that exactly? What am I looking for that I'm not getting? And the really, I think that the most interesting thing was that it had very, very, very little to do with what we're taught matters. It had very little to do with plot. It had very little to with plot per se. Very, very little to do with how well it was written. And everything to do with whether or not it was actually a story and it was engaging me. And I was really pulled in and really had that desire to know what happened next, basically. And that turned out, I kind of thought, okay, what is it I'm looking for? And when I had kind of defined that, that was when I've always been interested in neuroscience as well, you know, it's kind of basically new, because I think kind of neuroscience and writers, neuroscientists and writers, we're after the same thing. What makes people tick? You know, why are we doing what we're doing? And so I realized at that point that what we were discovering in neuroscience really seemed to echo, you know, offer proof to what I thought I was looking for in every story that I read. And that led then to writing Wired for Story. Because, again, I think, and I know this would be a really bold statement, but I think everything we're taught about writing is wrong. It's just from kindergarten on, we're led down a path that just doesn't get 99.9% of writers there. Some people are naturals, and they can just do it. But the rest of us, which I fully in that ballpark, the rest of us are not focusing on what we really need to focus on in order to write something that is really going to have us. I love that line, have us at hello.
That's good. That's good. So you must have learned also as an agent what story was. I mean, you must have learned in that, you know, manuscripts or even query letters coming in that either triggered your interest or not, and why?
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, I think the biggest, to say the biggest problem is that most of the manuscripts that came in, and again, this is often even for people who are already accomplished, but here's a draft, were just a bunch of things that happened. There was nothing at stake. There was nothing from the very beginning where I went, okay, yeah, this is the point. I get where this is going. I see. I understand, you know, what the journey is going to be. Most of it was just a bunch of things that happened, which means either that the writer starts to write and is just going to kind of let it come out and pants, you know, I mean, right by the seat of their pants forward just to see what happens, and then you just get a bunch of things that happen. Or they've written out a plot that is a plot, an outline. They've been a plotter, and now they've written a bunch of things that will happen, and they're going to kind of plunk someone in to see how they would you know, navigate that maze that's already been set, and it's just boring. It's just a bunch of things that happened. If I wasn't instantly engaged and knew where I was going and had an idea of why what was going to happen in the plot was going to really matter to that protagonist, I didn't care. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter. Didn't grab you. And if it doesn't grab you, you don't go forward. Because that's a big mistake I think writers make. And I guess, and we do it, I mean, not on purpose, but we tend to think once you start reading something, it's kind of like you owe it to finish reading. I mean, people would often ask, well, as an agent, it was always a surprising question. How much does an agent read to really, you know, figure out, are they interested?
Yes.
And the answer is kind of self-evident. It's until the moment that they just don't care. And often, that's the first page.
Yeah.
That's the first paragraph. If we're not grabbed immediately, it just doesn't matter. Because as a reader, you know, you're not going to go into a bookstore. I know that makes me sound so old. You're not going to go into Amazon, you know, and look at that first page and read it and go, well, you know, it's kind of boring and I don't know where it's going and I don't get the point, but I'm sure the writer tried really, really hard, so I'm going to read it and then recommend it to all my friends. It's like, no, if it doesn't grab you, you click to the next title. Because why would you read forward otherwise?
Right, right. You know, and when you analyze now, I mean, books that are current and popular, and you read the first paragraph, and, you know, it's pretty apparent why some are working and, well, why the popular books, why the best-selling books are working and why those that sort of are released and disappear, why they don't work.
Oh, yeah. Story. I mean, you know, regardless the format, regardless the genre. I mean, the interesting thing is we come to story for the exact same things, and the exact same thing hooks us, regardless of the genre. It doesn't matter. I mean, people talk about the difference between literary fiction and commercial fiction. You know, one's plot-driven, one's character-driven. Could not be less true. All stories are character-driven. There's no such thing as a plot-driven novel. Certainly there are novels that have bigger plots with, you know, earthquakes and you know, and tidal waves. And, you know, one might say terrorist attacks at art museums because, I mean, it's like if you want to talk about the, you know, biggest literary novel of at least last year, The Goldfinch,
right.
It certainly starts with a major plot development. But it's not about that.
Right.
It's about how it's affecting this one character in the moment as they're struggling with what to do. Because story is internal, it's not external. And it starts with something internal, not something external. That's why if you create a plot first without first having a protagonist, somebody who's going to be affected by it and needs to overcome some misbelief to get what they want, two things that are already determined before you even start thinking about the plot, you're just going to have, and again, it's what agents and editors and those of us who, you know, out there, because there are so many self-published books now, you know, you start to look at it, and it is just a bunch of things that happen. You know, I can't tell you how many manuscripts I've read where if you ask me, what's it about, I'd say, it's about 300 pages. I have no idea. It's just a bunch of things that happen.
Yeah.
And that's not engaging.
Well, what's the difference then in, I mean, because obviously literary novels and more commercial novels are different in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
But in terms of getting story down, what's the difference then? Is it just the language and the care to language, or?
I don't think, I mean, it's a really good question. I don't think it's about language per se. I think that's one of those things that pulls us astray, where people go, I'm a wordsmith, or I have a love of language. And I always think, okay, what does love of language mean? It's like language is just a vessel that conveys meaning. It's the meaning that matters. And I would say that, for instance, taking a book like The Goldfinch, which I think is you could have used a little bit of help story-wise, but in terms of the depth that it goes to, I think it's probably the most brilliant thing I've ever read. I deeply love it.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
But reading that and then jumping back to something that would be more, you know, say a John Grisham or even Stephen King, who I actually really like,
mm-hmm.
it's that it doesn't go as deep. That's the difference. Because what we come to think about, you know, if you've read The Goldfinch or a book like The Goldfinch, you are so deeply into who that character is and how they are making sense of what's happening. And I think literary novelists go deeper there. And that's what's grabbing us. It's that they can take that depth and translate it into language. Because think about it. Because story is not about the things that happen in it. The story is about how those things affect us based on who we are and how we see the world. And how we see the world is based on everything that's happened to us up to the moment, if we're talking about a novel, when the story starts. That's literally how we humans make sense of things. It's a great book called Louder Than Words, The New Science on How the Mind Makes Meaning by a guy named Benjamin K. Bergen. And what he's talking about is we don't make meaning by learning some objective reality out there, and we all see the same objective reality, and, you know, except for people who are, like, really, really screwed up, and we hope they get a lot of therapy and join us back here on the page. We make sense of things based on one thing and one thing only, what our past experience has taught us, which means that you need to know what that is about your character, your protagonist, before you write word one. Otherwise, it's sort of like saying, I'm going to write a 300-page book about the most seminal events in someone's life who I know nothing about.
Mm.
So what the literary novels do is, first of all, they get that down first. And second of all, they can take us deeply into that experience, because that's what we come for, that inside information. I see what it looks like on the surface. What does it really feel like? What would that internal struggle really be to decide what to do next? And kind of think about it. When you're going to do something and you go, okay, what should I do? And now you're kind of relying on past experience, or even when you see something and it reminds you of something in the past. When it reminds you of that thing in the past, that great, oh, yeah, I remember home, like the holidays, right? All of us now are thinking about, or we'll get that feeling that reminds us of when we were little. And you don't, when you get that feeling and that image, you don't think in a linear form about everything that happened on that day. It's kind of like a hologram. It's a whole bunch of images together. You get one kind of glimpse of it. It's kind of grainy. And then it gives you that feeling in your stomach of, oh, yeah, that's what that was. A really great novelist can take that grainy kind of holographic, all those images together, and state them in a linear way that goes deep, and it still conveys that feeling, that emotion, that meaning. That's, I think, what literary novelists do that doesn't necessarily happen in more, you know, contemporary or I don't know, potboilers, I guess. Because I think a lot of genre fiction does go that deep. I don't even like that distinction that
mm-hmm,
much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that's the difference.
Mm, that's interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here today for the first time since early November, maybe, with Lisa Cron. Her book is Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence. What about memoirs?
I think memoirs are exactly the same. I mean, they're 100% the same. It's not what the person went through. It's how it changed them and what they learned as a result. And I don't mean that learned like edutainment mm-hmm. or anything on that level. But again, that's what we come to story for. We come to story for, okay, I see this difficult situation out there. I mean, that's the problem. Bad memoirs will just talk about something that happened, like something people go, oh, you should write about that because it's some very odd thing that happened or some very difficult thing. But in the world, we all understand that there are difficult things out there, and we don't need anyone to tell us about, you know, a particular difficult thing that happened to them. What we want to know is, but what's going on beneath the surface?
Mm-hmm.
What did that cost you? What did that learn? I often think of story as a difference between what we're saying out loud and what we're really thinking when we say it. Because those two things are really different, and, you know, which one is juicier, which one is more interesting, which one would you rather know when someone's talking to you? And memoir is exactly that. It's going in and saying, okay, if story is about how someone changes internally, who was I at the beginning? what was I struggling with, and who am I going to be at the end? And then it's finding the story in your story, which is difficult. I mean, it's funny. I think writing a memoir, it's like the great thing about it is you've got it right there. You've got so much to choose from. And the hard thing about writing a memoir is you've got so much to choose from. How do you know what to pick?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Well, this would be a great time to hear you read from Wired for Story. Would you do that?
Sure. And let me, I've picked out, I just have to say, I'm not the world's greatest reader, so you guys, let's see if I can if I can actually do this. So this is from chapter 3, which is "I'll Feel What He's Feeling." Most of us were brought up. Well, let me just say first, and the kind of the quote that begins it is Daniel Gilbert from "Stumbling on Happiness," who said, "Indeed, feelings don't just matter; they are what mattering means." Most of us were brought up to believe that reason and emotion are polar opposites, with reason as the stalwart white hat and emotion as the sulky black hat. And let's not even discuss which gender was said to wear which hat. Reason, it was thought, sees the world as it is, while that irrational scamp, emotion, tries to undermine it. Turns out, as neuroscience writer Jonah Lehrer says, if it weren't for our emotions, reason wouldn't exist at all. Take that, Plato. This is illustrated by a sad story that, even sadder, its real-life protagonist doesn't see at all, because he can't, literally. Elliot, a patient of, this is a neuroscientist and writer, Antonio Damasio, had lost a small section of his prefrontal cortices during surgery for a benign brain tumor. Before his illness, Elliot held a high-level corporate job, had a happy, thriving family. By the time he saw Damasio, Elliot was in the process of losing everything. He still tested in the 97th percentile in IQ and had a high-functioning memory. He had no trouble enumerating each and every possible solution to a problem. Trouble was, he couldn't make a decision. From what color pen to use to whether it was more important to do the work his boss expected or spend the day alphabetizing all the file folders in his office. Why? Because, as Damasio discovered, the damage to his brain left him unable to experience emotion. As a result, he was utterly detached and approached life as if everything in it was neutral. But wait, shouldn't that be a good thing? Now that emotion couldn't butt in and cloud Elliot's judgment, he'd be free to make rational decisions, right? I think you know where this is going. Without emotion, each option carried the exact same weight. Everything really was six of one, half a dozen of the other. Turns out, as cognitive scientist Steven Pinker notes, emotions are the mechanisms that set the brain's highest level goals, along with, apparently, every other goal, down to what to have for breakfast. Without emotion, Elliot had no way to gauge what was important and what wasn't, what mattered and what didn't. It is exactly the same way when it comes to story. If the reader can't feel what matters and what doesn't, then nothing matters, including finishing the story. The question for writers, then, is where do those feelings come from? The answer is very simple: the protagonist.
Thank you so much. That was Lisa Cron reading from Wired for Story. I became really interested in your book because at the end of my classes, I always use money that my students pay as fines. I fine them if they don't do their homework, or if they feel guilty for the writing they did that week that they didn't do enough. And then I use the money and I buy books generally for them at the end of the session. So one of the books I came across was yours, and I was really sad to give it away because it looks so interesting. So that's how I came across your book, because I was just scanning through it in the bookstore, and I just found so much interesting. And one thing that I underlined in my copy is early on you say, a recent brain imaging study reported in Psychological Science reveals that the regions of the brain that process the sights, sounds, tastes, and movement of real life are activated when we're engrossed in a compelling narrative.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting. Could you embellish?
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. I mean, that's, I mean, it brings us to, well, what is the purpose of story, and why do we so deeply misunderstand it? Because absolutely, there have been more studies since then. It's such a burgeoning field. And literally, when you're engrossed in a story, and it's based on what's happening to the protagonist, what's happening to the protagonist travels those same neural pathways that would be activated if you were actually doing what that protagonist is doing. You really are there. I mean, story is, think of story as the world's first virtual reality, you know, minus that kind of geeky visor. It really does allow us to experience things that we haven't yet gone through to figure out, what would I do in that case? How would I really survive? And the mistake that I think we make is that we tend to think that the great feeling we get when we're lost in the story is the point of the story. That's why we think of stories as entertainment, and we dismiss it as that. You know, stories are great; they're very entertaining. Our lives would be far drabber without stories, but you know, we survive just fine because story doesn't serve any actual purpose. But that really couldn't be less true. Story really is how we got here. Without that, we'd only have the perpetual now. And I don't care what Eckhart Tolle says, it's good to be in the now sometimes. If you were always in the now, you wouldn't know that there was, you know, even a tomorrow that might come. And so, you know, we'd be completely bowled over by whatever happened. Story is what allows us to envision that and then plan for the future. And I think the really interesting thing to go to that biological level is that the reason that stories feel good is so we'll pay attention to them and learn, you know, to run from the lion or to kind of figure out if somebody's acting really shady, what should I do? And the thing that pulls us into a story isn't arbitrary, it isn't pleasure for pleasure's sake, it's not love of language, it's actually biological. What happens is when you get grabbed by a good story, you get that great feeling, comes from a surge of dopamine, which is your brain's way of rewarding you and urging you to follow your curiosity, because it's curiosity that stirs up the dopamine. What's going to happen next? That urges you to follow that story because you just might learn something that you need to know. And I think kind of the end takeaway is that we don't turn to story to escape reality. We turn to story to navigate reality. In other words, story feels good for the same reason food tastes good, because without it, we couldn't survive. And we don't tend to know that as writers. We tend to be pulled into it's about the beautiful language, it's about lovely images, it's about great metaphors. And even if you do all of that really, really well and you don't have a story, it's about as appealing as a, you know, perfectly rendered bowl of waxed fruit and as moving as a intricately tricked out car with no engine. It just sits there. It's what's known in the trade as a beautifully written who cares. but the thing is, I mean, Barbara, if I could just say, the thing is story comes first. It's really so much needs to be done before you start on page one of the novel. And I don't really consider it pre-writing. I consider it all comes into the novel, but there's so much you need to know before you can create a plot, because otherwise you just end up with a bunch of things that happen because the story's not about the plot. Stories about how the plot affects the protagonist, and that means you need to know that person first, and not in general, but certain very specific things.
Yeah, that's so interesting. When we come back, we're going to take a real short break. When we come back, I would love to talk about the starting point. You know, you talked about how agents, editors will read maybe even a line or a paragraph before they and put the book down or the query letter or the manuscript or whatever. I'd love to talk a little bit about that when we come back. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Lisa Cron. Don't go away.
Closer than before, let's imagine something more, then we'll make it real today. And don't say goodbye tonight, save that kiss for the morning light, till the sun comes up. possibilities, they can wait another day. Baby, the streets are danger zone. Don't go out there all alone. You'll feel better if you stay. And don't say goodbye tonight. Save that kiss for the morning light. Till the sun comes up, we'll be lost in us. Don't say goodbye, the night was made for love.
Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. We're also on Stitcher. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Lisa Cron. Her book is Wired for Story. Before I go on, let me tell you that the views and opinions that you hear on the show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of my guest and me. And if you need to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. That's my website. And we usually keep the schedule up to date. Lately, it's probably not so up to date because I've been a bit out of it for a while. I'm getting back to it. My first show since early November. Happy to be here and happy to be on with Lisa. Hi there.
Hey.
So we were talking about agents and readers and beginnings of books or novels or whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking of students. I'm thinking of writers I know. I'm thinking of myself. And the starting point is often a difficult you know, beginnings, you know, we futz with beginnings so much, too much, really. And it's hard to, sometimes to know where exactly to begin. I mean, we think all this stuff is important because otherwise, you know.
Right. I'm going to fill you in on everything you need to know so my story will make sense once it starts.
Yeah. Instead of getting right to it, can you talk a bit about the starting point, maybe how, as a writer, to know when you have it?
Well, see, I think the biggest mistake writers make is that's where they want to start. I want to write a novel. I'm going to go to the first page. Where do I begin? And when you get to that first page, you should have already been working for months before you get to, okay, this is the beginning of the novel. Because otherwise it is like writing a 300-page book about someone, you know, an important event in someone's life who you know nothing about. If you do the work that I really think needs to be done beforehand, you will 100% know exactly where that begins. But to just start and try to figure it out, unless you are a natural storyteller, and even of the people who are published, I would say, you know, 0.00% are just people who can just come out of the gate and start to write. Most people really need to turn around and figure out, okay, who is this character? What do they need? What is holding them back? And I don't mean in general. And the biggest problem with when people start is they'll think of a general problem, a general reason why, and now they're going to put their character onto the page and take it through. And there's a ton of work that needs to be done beforehand, because story is, if you don't mind, let me just talk about for one sec what a story actually is.
Yeah.
Because I think that this is a mistake that people make. People think a story is about, you know, something that happens, which is true. Things happen in stories. Like, okay, story is something that happens to someone, and that's true. There's a protagonist, but it's way more than that. Okay, something dramatic or life-changing, very true, but there's way more to it than that. This is what a story is. If you don't mind, I'll say it once, and then I'll break it down. A story is how what happens affects someone in pursuit of a difficult goal and how they change as a result. And so to break it down, a story is how what happens, and that's the plot. That is the surface of the story. It is so deeply not what the story is about. You can't begin with that and go forward. That's why, for me, if I could burn every copy of The Hero's Journey and Hero's Voyage and all of those story structure books, I would there'd be a big, giant bonfire, because they're just a bunch of things that happen.
Right.
So it's about, you know, what happens, how it affects someone. That's the protagonist. That's whose skin your reader's going to be in. As we're just saying a minute ago, they're going to feel what that character feels. So everything that happens over there in your plot is going to get its meaning and emotional weight based on one thing and one thing only, how it's affecting your protagonist, and not affecting them in general, like, you know, it's raining and I'm cold, so I'm going to go get a raincoat, but affecting them in pursuit of a difficult goal, some hard thing that they're going forward and that they want, something's holding them back, because all stories are about how somebody solves a problem. So if your protagonist isn't uncomfortable, you got a problem from the get-go. So how they solve a difficult problem and then how they change as a result. And that's what the story is actually about. It's not about what happens in the plot. It's about how that changes the protagonist internally. And that means that all protagonists, and this brings us to your question, all protagonists enter a story before they walk onto page one with two things already deeply embedded. Something that they really, really want that has meaning for them beyond the surface, like I want $1 million so I can have a lot of money, and something that's holding them back, which I like to call a misbelief, because it's, some people call it a fatal flaw, some people call it a wound. I don't like those terms as catch-alls, because fatal flaw sounds pejorative. You know, like, you got a flaw, and hopefully this will help you get over that, or wound makes you sound like a victim. Misbelief is a way that we see the world that probably worked for us at the time, because we believe what we believe in order to help us to survive. Is probably a misbelief from the get-go, but now it's changed how we see things, and it's holding us back. And the story, the plot, is constructed to force the character to kind of go after this thing that they've wanted and to get over the misbelief in order to get it, which means you need to know those two things in detail. And when I say in detail, I don't mean, again, like, write a bio. I think those are as worthless as knowing nothing, because bios tend to be general. I mean really going in and going, okay, this is what my story is going to be about. I've got some basic idea of my what-if, of what the plot's got, some idea of what's going to happen. Now I'm going to figure out who it's going to happen to. Now I'm going to figure out why it matters to that person. And now I'm going to go back into their past, because, again, you can't write forward unless you, when that character walks onto the page, they're already evaluating things based on what happened to them in the past. If you don't know those things in detail, in scene form, all the way out scene form, how do you know how they're going to read what happens? How do you know how they're going to make sense of it? Because, again, the other big mistake that comes with the way things, I think, the way story tends to be taught in a big way, is that it's all about what happens externally, and it's not the internal thought process. And that's where the story lies. It lies in that internal struggle. And if you look at a book, I think The Goldfinch is a perfect example of it. You look and you see the main character, Theo, struggling with what to do, with how he's making sense, the meaning he's reading into what's happening and what he should do as a result. That's where the story lies. And the only way you can know that is to know these specific past things about your character. And it's not pre-writing, and it doesn't just stay there, because they then become part of the novel. In other words, when the character's in struggling with what to do, these are the thoughts that go through their head. This is how they weigh it. This is what things mean. And if you look now, you'll see in almost any book, It is there 100%. And yet writers are often taught, oh, yeah, don't tell us what the character's thinking. Just have it, you know, be through action. And it just couldn't be less true. I think the reason we don't know it's that consciously is because the first job of a good story is to completely anesthetize the part of our brain that knows it is a story. So it feels like life, and the two things we can see when we're seduced in that way is the plot and the language. And so we think that's what it is. But the truth is, before you write, if you're just going to start writing from page one, you're lost. There's no point, in my opinion. You got to go back and do this stuff first. Because otherwise, you know, how do you know? You can't write forward to get to know your character, because that means that from up until that point, you had no idea how they saw. So every reaction they had was a general, generic reaction, or just a reaction that, you know, that was put on for that scene, not a full integrated person who has a goal and has, you know, whatever it is they need to get over to get it. Because that's what we do in life. Here's my agenda. It's like in life that's what we are. It's like you're the protagonist in your own life, and you evaluate everything, whether it's social or physical or conceptual, based on one thing and one thing only. How will this affect me, given what my agenda is? That's how we operate. And that's what we come to story for, because we want to know that stuff that people think and don't say out loud.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, as you're talking, I'm back to thinking about memoir and what seems to happen at times with new memoirists is that because they felt it,
right,
they think it's on the page.
Yes.
And maybe it's not on the page.
Exactly.
Maybe it's too generically on the page, or maybe there's not a scene on the
right
page, but just feelings.
Right. And feelings are, I mean, the biggest problem with the way that we look at feelings is that we tend to think of feelings as big box emotion. I was happy, I was sad, I was jealous, I was this. Feeling is actually in how we make sense of what's happening. That's why those specifics need to be on the page. Because then the reader, if you give the reader the specifics of what you're thinking about, of what it means to you as you're struggling with it, we're going to feel that emotion, happy, sad, or whatever. But again, we tend to think of emotion as big box emotion, and we tend to think of emotion, sadly, as being emotional, which is really just a very pitch, you know, a very, very specific pitch of emotion. Emotion drives everything. Everything we do based on one thing and one thing only, how we feel about it. And not because we're weak creatures, but because emotion's our barometer. And so we don't want to know what you felt. We want to know why. And the why comes from seeing the scene unfold, always. It's never the what, it's always the why, always. That's what I see what you did, I want to know why.
Yeah.
That's what we come for.
Hmm.
And you're right. The same thing's true of novelists. I mean, because think about it, and it's no one's fault. It's like when you're writing a story, you're seeing it. You know, you've got it really right there in front of you, so you read the words on the page, and of course you're already seeing it. The trick is for someone who only has the words on the page. I'll tell you something really interesting I read recently. It was a brain study where they took writers, and they took people who were not writers and people who were, you know, professional, I guess, you know, successful writers, and they put them through MRI machines while they were writing, and what they're thinking about is story. And what they discovered is people who are not, are trying to learn to write, are not professional writers, the part of their brain that lights up is the visual part. They're seeing something from the outside in. The writers, it was the language part, because now they're translating that into words that will make it clear to other people. So often when I'm working with writers, and they'll have some big panoramic thing that you're thinking, this is so boring. If I wanted a picture, I'd look at, you know, and they go, no, I can see it in my head. And it's like, yeah, okay. That's not the point. We want to know what's going on inside, not outside.
Mm. Well, you know, speaking of which, you have a chapter 6, the story is in the specifics.
Yeah.
We don't think in the abstract, we think in specific images. And that's another something I see going on, you know, when writers talk about, oh, it was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Or he was ugly, or, you know,
right,
very, very generic,
right,
adjectives that you just can't see.
Exactly. No, that's the biggest mistake that writers make. You know, with everything, is they'll have something out there, and they will draw a conclusion from it but we don't have the specific. We just get the conclusion. And you're right. When you say someone's ugly, well, what's ugly to me is going to be super different than what's ugly to you. And if you have the character saying why they think the person's ugly, that's going to tell us something about that person. And so now we have more information about them. And, of course, even with those kind of sensory details or descriptions, they still need to go toward the story that you're telling. You know, you don't tell it to us. You don't tell anything in a story just because. Because as far as a reader is concerned, everything in a story is there on a need-to-know basis. If we didn't need to know it, you wouldn't tell us. So when writers go on and on and on about what something looked like, but it has nothing to do with anything other than, hey, that's what it looked like, who cares? And we just get lost, and we do that thing. I mean, think about it in your own life. And we all have that, like our dithery friend Todd, who goes on and on and on about something, and you're thinking, okay, what's your point? Why are you telling me this? And you're trying to keep that smile on your face so you don't just jump and strangle him and go, you know, why do I need to know this? But writers don't ask themselves that question. And I think the reason they don't often is because they just start writing about something that happens. So they have no gauge to know, well, what's important and what isn't. That's why the way that I feel that I feel the best way to approach a story is if you know that first, you get that, okay, this is what it's about, this is this internal change. I like to call it the story's third rail. I said that to someone once in a UCLA class, and the student raised her hand and she went, what are the other two rails? And I realized, okay, I got to explain this more. The third rail is the rail in the subway car that supplies the juice. It's like you could have a perfectly tricked out subway car with tons of people in it, and if there's no electricity, it is just going to sit there. And the way the things that happen in the story, the plot, get their meaning is in terms of how they're touching on this internal struggle that the character walked onto the page with, already has it fully developed the minute they walk onto that page. And now everything that's happening in the plot is getting its meaning because it's forcing them to deal with that in one way or another. And that's what the reader's tracking. We're feeling that. When we talked about, you know, in the beginning and the way your brain lights up, it doesn't light up because in general someone's running. It lights up because they're running from someone who's trying to stop them from doing the thing that we know they need to do for a different reason than everybody else thinks. That's important. Mm-hmm.
This is great. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Lisa Cron. Her book is Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence. So what about outlines? What about figuring it all out before you get started? I mean, where are you on that?
I think it's funny because I'm doing a book somewhat like that right now. See, I don't think you can. I think the first thing you need to do is exactly what I've been talking about. First, you go back. First, you have a basic idea. I call it a what if. Okay, here's my basic, because you got to have somewhere to drill. It's like layers that you got to go down. Okay, here's the basic thing I want to write about. And then you drill down to, okay, who is this going to happen to? Then why is it going to matter? And then you really need to figure all of this stuff out before you start writing the plot. If you start outlining what is going to happen before you know why it needs to happen, you're just going to have a bunch of things that happen. So my feeling is, and there's no such thing as a general outline, even on that level. When you're going back and you're looking at your protagonist's past, because, again, everything in the story is there to affect your protagonist. Every other character is there to serve the story, everything. So when you dig down to that and you write it out, literally in scene form, again, not in some general paragraph, but in utter scene form, so you go, okay, where did this misbelief come from? What happened that twisted how this character sees the world? How has that now, like a snowball going downhill, affected them at certain seminal moments in their life that start to come clear as you go forward? And the thing to think of, you mentioned earlier, specific. I mean, yes, because specifics beget specifics. Generalities only beget other generalities. And the really interesting thing is once you start digging into it, it starts to appear. It starts to come forward, and you get, okay, well, if this happened to my character when they went to college and it has something to do with the story, that means this is what they're going to do in the plot. And the plot starts to appear out of this backstory. And then, of course, I don't even like calling it backstory because it has a bad connotation, but that backstory, again, now leapfrogs into the story itself in the form of either a flashback or you know, memories or ideas or ways that the character is debating, what should I do in this moment? Because, of course, I mean, if you look at, I think what's also so wonderful about the Goldfinch is Theo is always in that position. There's always something happening that's forcing him to go through. He's always got that internal conflict. Oh, my God, what do I do? And we feel tense because of that. Without that, we wouldn't, it would just be something that happened, and it wouldn't matter. In fact, I'm reading right now, I like Donna Tartt's, I went back and read The Secret History, which I liked. I'm reading now the Little Friend.
Uh-huh.
It's awful, because nothing happens. It's like all of this stuff, you're going, okay, what's the point? When is she going to go try to find this killer guy? It's just full of a bunch of things that happen, and it couldn't be duller on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also because she, for some reason, chose to write it in the third person, and I think first person is so much more involving very often.
Do you think that in general, first person?
I think third person can be great. I have no problem
mm-hmm.
with it. I don't understand why people write third person limited, because it's like, God, if you can only go into one person's head and see things, you know, one person's always got to be there, why would you not do it in the first person?
Right.
But I think third person can be, but I think first person's much more immediate. And often when I'm working with writers who are writing in the first person, I'll say, okay, I want you to go back and write that scene from a first person point of view. And it is amazing the difference that makes.
Do you find a difference between first person present tense, first person past tense?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. And I think first person present tense is really hard to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
If you're noticing it, you're not doing it well.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think that makes any difference. I mean, yeah, I don't. Because for me, it's all about the story. It's all about what am I going to learn, what journey am I going to go on, why am I going to care. And again, it does come down to the specifics, because if you think about your own life, it's like we never do anything in general. You don't go to school in general. You don't go to the market in general. You don't fall in love in general. Everything you do moment by moment specific. And if there's an art in writing, and I have trouble with all words that are conceptual. That's why I hate the word theme. I know I have it in my book, but now I've totally banished it. Because theme is this big, general, gooey thing. Like, what does that even mean? And it makes writers write all of this big, general stuff. Conceptual stuff, the whole, even of metadata, we made that up. It's just you and me and everybody we know. And what story does is it takes general things and it makes it super specific by how is it affecting one specific person, and that's how we get to the universal. It's like going back to the Goldfinch. I mean, hopefully, knock wood, none of us are going to have to go through what the character Theo went through. It's a totally unique story, totally unique person, and yet, on every page, you're pausing to go, oh, God, yeah, me too. Oh, God, yeah. If it's done well, that specifically, now we're going to take it, and that feeling is going to catapult us to that moment in our own lives where we had that experience. But, of course, you know, please let it be very different than the stuff that happens to him. But that's really what pulls us in, and that's really how we figure out where to start, and that's really what the reader comes, whether we know it or not. I mean, there's that old saw, you know, I think it was Coleridge who said, you know, a good story demands a willing suspension of disbelief. That could not be less true.
Hmm.
Because when a story grabs you, you have no recourse against it. It literally pulls you in. It's literally like you've now put your own biology, your own life on pause. You know, because think of, like, how many times have you done that where you go, oh, I got a big meeting tomorrow, I'm going to read one chapter and I'll go to sleep. You know?
Right,
it's like dawn. Because the idea of the meeting is gone, the idea of what being tired is gone. You are in the world of the story. It goes back to what we were saying earlier about the biology and the way it really does. You take over your brain. It takes over. It's like you've put that virtual reality, you know, visor on, and now that is the world. You've left your own world. You are in the world of the story, but that means you're inside the protagonist. That protagonist is your avatar. If we don't see how they're making sense of it in the moment, on the page, as they react to it, then it's just something that happens.
Hmm. We could have used a couple hours. I have more I'd like to talk to you about. Unfortunately, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if there's anything else. I mean, there must be a lot else that you could talk about, but anything we could leave our listeners with, our listeners who are working on novels and memoirs and essays.
I would say it was just the last thing that I just said, because the big mistake that writers make is they'll have something happen and they don't have their character draw a conclusion. And really, think about your own life. What you're doing is you're trying to figure out what to do, and you're reading the terrain. And you're not reading the terrain in general, but you're reading the terrain in, is this going to help me or hurt me? What should I do as a result? So really, everything you put out there, you want your protagonist to draw a strategic conclusion from it that then in some way changes or motivates what they do next. that really, really makes a difference.
I so appreciate your time, and especially on this special day as we are moving into a new year. It's been great talking with you, Lisa.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Lisa Cron. Her book is Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence, published by 10 Speed Press. And hopefully we'll have this up on the website in a week or so. So if you tuned in too late or you want to listen again, it will be there at penonfire.com. All podcasts are basically there on penonfire.com. You can sign up there to get on the email list to be notified when I podcast past shows. And you get an email that says it's been podcasts, and then you can listen. Anyway, you've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I thank you, our loyal listeners, for being here with us this year. And however many years you've been with us, with Marie, Nicole, and I. And I do hope you'll be back with us next year, next Wednesday. Have a safe, happy, wonderful new year. And remember to stay in the chair. Be well.
Nessa trepada, nessa batida. A gente vai chegando devagar. E beleza, Sérgio Mendes, um arraso no pedaço, botando pra quebrar, chegando junto. Seu Jorge, tamo junto na
Se um clarão lilás te banhar de luz, não te acanhes, não sou eu. Se uma estranha paz te vestir de azul, não te espantes, não sou eu. Se descer dos céus o dragão lunar, manda me chamar, pelo amor de Deus. Pois teu anjo bom, teu Ogum Egê, teu Alá Bedê, sou eu.
É, e como diz aqui, rapaz, meu parceiro Ney Lopes, é a posição das vibrações positivas que vem do céu. E agora, Sérgio Mendes, arrebenta.
Descer dos céus o dragão do mar, manda me chamar, pelo amor de Deus. Pois teu anjo bom, teu Ogum Egê, teu Alá Bedê, sou eu. Clarão lilás te banhar de luz, não te acanhes, não sou eu. Pois teu anjo morre.